We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. And we're also, of course, pleased to have back on the program this morning Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is a program that we do every month, and we've been doing those shows for a long time, so that you will have a regular opportunity to ask home maintenance questions. And we have talked about a lot of things on the show, about heating and cooling, about doors and windows, insulation, gutters, basements, attics, you name it. You got some kind of problem and you're not sure how to deal with it, you should give us a call and Scott will see if he can help you out. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you make the call and it's on us. That's 800-222-9455. Also, by the way, if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David. I always enjoy coming on and talking with the folks.
So we're in a kind of a transitional period now, and I imagine probably a lot of folks are still, at least some point, are still using their furnaces. I think we're a little ways away from air conditioning. Is it too early, though, to start thinking about air conditioning?
Well, that's a good question. The problem with thinking about air conditioning quite this early is it needs to be warm enough for the compressor to run safely. Mm-hmm. If the compressor has not had a chance to warm up, if it's behind the bushes or on the backside of the house where it doesn't get any sunlight and it's still cold, then you really don't want to run it to where you'd actually test it. Now, of course, this is a good time to change the furnace filters to make sure that we're getting good airflow before we go into the cooling season. And it is not a bad idea to have the air conditioner checked every couple years to make sure that it is operating efficiently, make sure we've got the correct amount of Freon in it so that it will continue to give you use. It helps if you check it early on, because that's when the furnace guys, the air conditioner guys, aren't so busy dealing with emergencies. So, rather than wait until, hey, it's broke, I need somebody here right away, and of course it's 102 degrees outside, and they've got 14 other calls, calling them early and having them come out and check and do a pressure check on the unit is not a bad idea. But it does need to be above 55 or 60 degrees for 2 or 3 days before we even think about turning on the air conditioner to try and check the compressor.
Okay. That's, one of the things that I know we've talked about, or maybe talked about it with your dad, was that you really, in the wintertime, you don't want by accident the air conditioning to go on.
It's not a good idea. The air conditioner compressor has to compress a Freon gas, depending on which makeup they're running now. When the gas has to be compressed, first of all, it means it has to be in a gaseous state. And if things are to the point where we might have a little bit of a liquid in the line, a liquid does not compress, so you can do what they call slugging the compressor. Basically, we get a liquid in there, and the compressor tries to compress it. It stops the compressor dead. It could damage it significantly. So, yeah, it's not a good idea to turn it on when it's cold outside.
Anyway, we have a caller here, somebody in Morton Grove. So we'll get right to them. Line number 4, they're our first. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah.
Actually, it's two small questions. One's a recommendation. But the question that I have is I'm getting, I've just noticed that in the basement area, there is a crack, and we've had some seepage there. It was hidden by something else that we have had in the house, and I moved that away to find that this crack is there. And I wondered, is that something someone has to be very skilled to deal with, or is it something I could get at the local hardware store and just, squeeze it in through the cracks and let it heal itself? And the second one was a recommendation, but okay, I'll ask that question.
All right. Is this a poured concrete foundation?
This is.
So you've got poured concrete walls and you've got a crack in the wall somewhere?
Yeah, it runs about, it's a split level, so we're about 3 or 4 feet underground, and it probably runs the better part of that distance.
Okay, is it vertical up and down, or is it a horizontal crack?
It's actually like diagonal.
Diagonal off a corner at a window or something like that?
No, it's kind of in the center of the room. It's, I don't know, maybe a 90-degree diagonal, you know, something like that.
Okay. When you have a poured concrete wall, it's not uncommon to have some type of shrinkage cracks. When you pour concrete, it comes in wet off a truck. It continues to dry for about the first year or two, and so we do get some shrinkage or some movement. So when we're looking at cracks, I'm looking very carefully at, okay, is it wider at the top or the bottom, or does it seem to be pretty consistent top to bottom or all the way through? If it's pretty consistent all the way through, it's most likely a shrinkage crack where the concrete is just dried and there's less mass there than when it was poured. So, you know, when you have a large quantity of concrete and it dries, something has to move because we lose all the water once it dries. To have some moisture seeping through it generally means that the drainage or slope of the exterior yard is allowing some water to collect next to our foundation. And that water collecting next to the foundation then soaks through the window. Well, ideally what we want, or not through the window, through the crack. Ideally what we want is the soil outside to be sloped such that that water does not collect next to the foundation, so therefore it doesn't come through the foundation. Fixing a crack, water coming through a crack from the inside, is kind of the backwards way of doing it. If the water's coming through the wall, the last thing we want to do is stop it on the inside. We want to stop it on the outside, either by keeping the water drained away or sealing the crack from the outside if you can get to it, checking gutters, make sure not overflowing. If the crack is such that you can't do much about it, you're going to get water there, there are several different types of epoxy that they can put into the crack. Some of them are structural grade. Basically, they'll glue a little tube with some epoxy in the crack, and then they'll use a syringe and squeeze it in there and then let the epoxy dry, and the epoxy then seals the crack. Structurally, it actually bonds the concrete back together so that it has a proper structural integrity. Most of the time, that's not necessary, so that you could come in. They've got a couple of different crack fillers, concrete fillers, that you may have to kind of put some tape or something over it and try and squeeze it in with, fairly thin with a turkey baster type something or other, just to try and get it into the crack. But you could seal the crack with just about anything if we're just worried about the water. If it's actually a structural crack, then yes, we do need to use some special epoxies.
Okay.
But what I would say first is verify that it is not a structural problem.
Uh-huh.
Look at it. If there's been any shifting, any movement, make sure it's not wider at one point than another. Make sure you can't see where there's been a shift in the mating surfaces. If that's the case, then I would probably worry about getting my water drained away on the outside and then putting just some silicone or a concrete patch filler into the crack itself to help reduce some of the water coming through it.
Oh, okay, that's a great idea. Okay, the second item is kind of gone out of my mind, I'm sorry to say. I guess it's old age setting in here, I'm not sure. Can I call later in the program?
Sure, if it occurs to you again, call back, that's fine.
Okay, thank you.
All right. In studio here with us this morning, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's here once a month. We talk about home maintenance. And if you have a question or you got a problem, you don't know what to do about it, give us a call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And you can send us an email, too, if you like, will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu. We have somebody here on cell phone. I think they're in Urbana, calling from Urbana. It's our line, number one. Hello.
Hi there.
Yeah, hi.
I have a question. We live in about a 100-year-old four-square style house with a hipped roof, that pyramid kind of roof. It's got three dormers, a full set of stairs going up there. We'd like to finish that and have living space up there. The problem is the roof is framed in just with 2x4s, and I'm concerned about having enough headroom. How can I make sure that's well insulated well-ventilated. Can you kind of walk me through the spacing and how much insulation I'll need?
I can give you a couple ideas. Unfortunately, you're probably not going to like most of them.
Generally speaking,
attic areas are not intended for floor load. Therefore, they have a 2x6 framing instead of a 2x8 or 2x10 framing. So, therefore, you're not supposed to put any heavy items up there, bookcases, living spaces, things like that. In order to make them strong and correctly support the floor loads and get a pound per square inch that is considered to be a live load, you'd almost need to put in new floor joists, at least a 2x8, which, of course, raises the floor, which changes the stairs. So now the stair has a trip hazard because the top stair is taller than any of the rest of the stairs. It gets you closer to the ceiling. Then, yes, a 2x4 framing on the rafters is not enough for insulation. Right now, your insulation is in the floor. You'd end up moving the insulation from the floor up to the ceiling. Well, we should have 8 to 10 inches of insulation. We should have a 1 to 2 inch air gap between the insulation and the roof sheathing. So now we've got to frame the roofing down 10 to 12 inches to be able to get enough room for our insulation and our ventilation to maintain the insulation level that we have currently. So by the time you raise the floor up 2 or 3 inches and you lower the ceiling 10 to 12 inches, now all of a sudden your great big open space becomes a little tiny hallway that you bump your head on going around corners because everything has dropped back down on you.
Right.
So unless it's really a spacious attic, most of the time converting attic space is not recommended.
Okay. So even though there's a full set of stairs in the dormers and it looks like a former owner kind of semi-finished it, it's not real practical space.
It's not, generally speaking, practical space. Without, you know, coming in there and doing a structural analysis, okay, what do we have for floor joists? Usually what I'll do, if it's already floored up there, which I'm assuming it probably is,
yeah, it is.
I'll take a small screwdriver or something and I'll stick it down through the floorboards and I'll find out how thick the floor framing actually is. A 2x6 framing, I think you'll find if you walk somewhere in the attic that you know is over a room and you bounce a little bit, the whole ceiling downstairs will start bouncing. So the next thing you know is all your plaster ceilings in the downstairs rooms start coming loose from the ceilings because the live load or the bounce load that you've put into your attic area.
Right.
So unless you've got a good series of walls on the second floor that are supporting the attic area and the attic framing is such that we don't have any long spans, it's a lot more involved to convert that space into living space than what most people think about. Also, when you have that space converted, you don't have any heating and air conditioning up there, so we have to think of how we're going to control the temperature up there.
Right.
So that.
How about those those dents, pink, different kinds of foam that look like they may have a higher R value but a lot more dense than just like a loose attic insulation, which you're used to seeing?
Well, okay, depends on what you're going to be satisfied with for insulation. Generally speaking, a pink board or a blue board has an R value of about 7. The R value is an inverse proportion to heat loss. 1/7 of the heat that gets to that board over a given time period passes through it. The other 6 parts are reflected back. Right now for Illinois, our central Illinois, we recommend for new construction an R50 to an R55.
Yep.
So obviously an R7 board, which is a 2-inch foam board, is not going to cut it.
Right.
So you're going to need several layers of it. So again, you're going to end up with a spacing issue. Also, anytime you use a foam insulation in a living space, it needs to be covered with a fire-resistant material. You can't just put a paneling over the top of it. It has to be like a Class X drywall or a fire-rated paneling. So that what happens is foam insulation, when it burns, if there were ever a fire, will put off toxic fumes which could overcome you long before the flames would.
Got it.
So there's a lot of things to be considered. I do know that a couple of the insulation companies are making some basement paneling systems for insulating your basement with basically a foam and vinyl. I don't know if those type of walls you'd be able to modify them to have enough insulation for your attic space or not. I'm guessing not really, because most of your heat going up so that we need all of our insulation up there in that upper area, but we can't block all the insulation. Otherwise, we'll end up with condensation issues, mold and mildew issues, things like that between the insulation and the roof sheathing.
Okay. Thanks for the info.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, just I'm just now the question of plaster pops into my head, and I think about how, you know, there's still probably a lot of older houses that have plaster in them, although pretty much we've moved away from plaster and now we do wallboards. I'm sure that's a lot easier. It's cheaper. If you see somebody do plaster, you don't really know what artistry is. You really, not an easy thing to do. But when you see somebody who knows how to do it, it's just a beautiful thing to watch. Anyway, are there good ways to deal with older plaster walls and ceilings that have problems?
The biggest problem with the plaster is that it continues to dry throughout its entire lifetime. So if you've got a house that was built in the 1910, 1920 area where we used a lot of plaster, that stuff's been drying now for 90 years. Mm-hmm. It's pretty brittle. So when the wood in the house expands and contracts with temperature and moisture changes, we can break off what they call the keys. Plaster is installed by actually slathering on or troweling on a semi-liquid plaster, something that's dense, but it's allowed to flow a little bit. And you put it in over a wood lath or a metal lath, something where the plaster can go through and then lean over, fall over, and create this lock into whatever the lath we have. Well, as it gets older and the house moves a little bit, the keys or the lock that holds the plaster to the wood lath starts breaking loose. So now you end up with large pieces of plaster that have little or no anchoring to the ceiling or wall. And when you start making big changes, such as converting attic areas, installing the grand piano on the second floor instead of the first floor, things like that will then make changes in the wood framing and how the plaster has basically taken its set. I mean, the first few years, first 15 or 20 years, this stuff's pliable enough, it gets away with that. But as we start getting older and older and you start looking at houses, you'll notice that there's more cracking of the plaster due to the fact that it's getting more and more brittle. And there is, once the keys are broke, there are no real good ways of putting the plaster back up. It's not uncommon to take thin drywall, 3/8 drywall, and just use long screws and put the screws right through the plaster and basically pinch the plaster back up in place by installing drywall over the top of it. And that's usually the fastest, easiest, most economic repair for cracked plaster ceilings. And you can do it on the walls as well if your walls crack. But most of the time, most of our cracks are in the ceiling areas. It's on those older houses, finding somebody that can do good plaster work is difficult, particularly if you're trying to get somebody to match it so that it doesn't appear to have this big patch in the middle of your dining room area.
And is it even worth it if you got hairline cracks? Particularly, you know, we have an older house, and there seem to be some cracks here and there. It's at the corners. Is that even worth trying to patch up?
I would probably, particularly if it's a dining room, living room, one of our show areas of the house, yes, I would probably do some minor patchwork. I probably wouldn't try and do anything significant. If you end up with a lot of loose areas, then, we need to start thinking about possibly either pulling it down, which is a messy job, or putting in a drywall over the top of it.
Okay. We have some other callers here. Let's go to Champagne, line one, right here. Hello.
Yeah, hi.
Uh-huh.
David, you should call in if you have a question.
Hey, it's my show. I get to ask questions.
I know that. You do a good job.
Thanks.
Actually, what's happened is I was listening because, over time, I've heard and certainly had, them over doing work and, inspections for me. But anyway, what is the R value that's recommended for new buildings for ceilings?
Right now, it's about R55.
Oh, really? Okay. Okay, that's good. And what about for the sidewalls?
Well, wall construction is pretty much limited by the framing that you use. Most of our framing, of course, is 2x4 framing.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the insulation that goes into 2x4 framing is considered to be an R11. They do have a dense bat, which is an R13. Now, most of the time we do consider a 2x4 wall to be able to go to R19. Now, we are taking into account the R value of the siding, the R value of the sheathing on for the siding, the drywall on the inside, plus the insulation in the middle. But the insulation itself is usually either R11 or R13.
What does brick give you then, increasing the R value? Does it help that much? Or?
Zero.
Is that right? Okay.
Yeah, brick will actually transfer heat in and out. Now, it can act as a time delay. If you've got a brick veneer or stone veneer, the sun hits it, it takes a while for the heat to work its way through. Matter of fact, a lot of the veneered homes, masonry veneered homes, you'll find your peak cooling time is actually 6, 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night rather than during the day when the sun is the brightest, because the heat that the brick picked up over the noon hour slowly works its way through the brick and then actually starts warming the house later.
The other one is any new solutions for, I don't know, is it a truss? I guess that beam that runs in the attic all the way, is that right? Is that what that's called?
A truss, yes.
Yeah. What's happened is the house was built in 1978. And I guess in terms of the what was used for the material, so what happens in the winter is that, you know, in other words, it lifts, you know, the ceiling lifts, and then I get the crack around the side. And the only way, is there anything that's new that can be put on there rather than, I know the solution generally is that, what, you put the molding up there and you attach it to the ceiling, and then when it moves, you don't see it, you know, or it doesn't crack. Am I clear on that?
What you're describing is called truss rise, and truss rise is something that was actually a lot of the research was done at the Small Homes Council, University of Illinois here in town, checking to see what caused it, and they determined basically when you have the bottom portion of your truss, which is a triangle with web members up and down in between it to give it some additional structural strength so we can span a longer distance with 2x4s rather than have to go to a 2x6, 2x8, 2x10 type construction, since the 2x10s are getting harder to find and more expensive. So we have this engineered system which is designed to take all the roof load, transfer it out to the outbearing walls, the perimeter walls, so that we can hold the weight up without having load-bearing walls in the center of the house. What happens is the bottom cord ends up getting buried in insulation. When we're talking in R55, we're looking at 14 to 18 inches of insulation easy on top of there. So it stays pretty much one temperature year-round. The upper portions of our truss, of our triangle, get exposed to outdoor temperature, outdoor humidity, and so they expand and contract with temperature and humidity changes. Well, you cannot move two sides of a triangle without the third side doing something. So what ends up happening is the two at the top get shorter in the wintertime. It means the one at the bottom ends up bowing or arcing up to try and shorten up the span. This will lift your ceiling up off your wall. Now, I did have one contractor say that's not going to happen to me. He cuts holes in the walls. He puts a metal strap from the wall over the top of the truss and back down to the wall stud again, plasters it all up, says, hey, it's good. Yeah, next winter we came over there, and the wall was now a half an inch above the floor. It literally picked the wall up. So when Mother Nature says that truss is going to move, it's going to move. If you have a situation where we have that truss rise, there is not a lot we can do with it without major work. Reconnecting the ceiling drywalls on clips and slides rather than directly to the trusses, things like that. So usually this simple thing is to put a crown molding over the top of the crack, attach the crown molding to the ceiling so it goes up and down. Only paint in the wintertime when the crown molding is up so that you don't end up with a paint line every time it tries to shrink on you. We have worked with the truss companies over the years. My father, the Small Homes Council, what they've decided is that if they use better lumber for, or stiffer lumber for the bottom cord, in other words, if you look at the end of the board, if it has a straighter wood grain, it's closer to the, grown closer to the outside of the tree, it's a little bit stronger, it helps resist that. They also now make clips, so when you put your ceiling drywall up, you don't attach it direct to the truss. You attach it to a clip that is nailed to the truss, and their clip has a slot in it to allow the truss to move up and down behind it. You have to look at it like this. It's a status symbol. If you did not have good insulation in the attic, this problem would not exist.
Okay. Well, actually, I trust both of you. So thanks for the I thought maybe there might be something new, but that was, you know, it makes sense. So I'll just have to do it that way.
All right.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thanks.
Bye-bye.
And just for, you said now the recommendation for ceiling insulation is R55.
R55.
And how much insulation does it take to get that?
Well, an R30 bat is an 8-inch bat. So we are looking at roughly 15-16 inches of insulation.
Okay. Our guest this morning on Focus is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month. It's always a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. We're about midway through. We have some other callers, and we'll take them in the order they came in. And, of course, so would welcome anybody if you have a question. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You can also send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. Next up, Champaign County, line two.
Hi. I wanted to ask you about something, awnings, but before I do that, I want to mention as far as plaster walls, plaster washers are a little hard to get a hold of, but if you have some bulges in an old plaster wall, you can screw these things in with drywall screws and pull them tight, and I had some success. I've got a really old house, and the foundation's uneven, so there's really only so far one can go until one rectifies that. But plaster washers, you need to then skim drywall joint compound over it and do the treatment. But
yeah, there are ways of anchoring the re-anchoring it, but you're still re-anchoring a very brittle surface. So yeah, you put a couple of screws in, you get one tight, it ends up cracking around it, and you do have to go over it with a skim coat. In the long run, unless you're doing it yourself and you just it's a labor of love, in the long run it's probably less expensive to go over it with the drywall and just seal it up.
Yeah, well, they're not mutually exclusive either, so you can tighten it up and
correct
and drywall over it. I've done that too. Well, by the way, sun tubes are wonderful.
yes, they are.
They've come up a number of times, and I've installed some and enjoyed really bright light, even on a dark day, because I guess over the winter. So, but now I'm turning my attention to keeping the west summer light out and the heat load out, and I've got some fixed awnings I'm going to install, but I was thinking if you knew about any kind of individual window retractable awnings. I've been seeing on some home shows, mainly out of the south, where there's all sorts of exterior window treatments for sun load, like sort of the Venetian blinds that you see on a sliding door on the inside. There's some that are rated for outside use that I seem to be using. Probably more in the south, where air conditioning costs are more onerous. But have you seen any? There's a brand called New Image that seems to have a interesting looking retractable awning. Have you seen any of these around? And I'll hang up. Listen.
All right.
Here.
Well, I really haven't done much research in the retractable awnings. Generally speaking, retractable awnings in this area, because of the high winds we have and the weather that we have, they have a pretty short lifespan. So unless you're using an area outdoors, or you really have no shade whatsoever and you need to try and pick up a little bit, it's kind of questionable whether or not you actually get a cost benefit from it, because they just don't last as long, because we can't use them in high winds, which kind of rules out an awful lot of days around here. And between the rain and the wind and the weather, they've got about a 4 to 7 year lifespan. So unless you're saving enough to actually pay for them in that time period, it's not necessarily feasible. So I really haven't done a whole lot of research into it. You can do some coatings on the windows, window tinting film. Most of the time we'll have a pretty significant block on both UV and heat loss, or heat gain, solar gain. So just putting some type of light tint work on the windows on the outside will make a big difference in how much heat you're getting. Hopefully what has happened is where our trend is getting more towards reusing overhangs. You know what I mean by that? At one point in time, we had really nice overhangs on all the houses, and then we decided we want them to look a little more attractive and everything to look a little bit different, so they started changing some of the roof designs. The overhang is actually a very ingenious shade method. In the wintertime, the sun is lower in the horizon, so it will come down underneath an overhang. In the summertime, the sun is higher on the sky, so therefore an overhang will shade the windows. So a properly designed roof will actually help reduce your solar gain in the summertime, so it reduces your cooling load. Meanwhile, allowing the warmth of the sun to come in the wintertime and help you pick up a little bit of solar gain in the wintertime. So a house is designed with a good overhang system will be more energy efficient than one that is more architecturally designed with a little or no overhang. Now, that being said, if you've got a home that where you are getting a lot of sunlight coming through there, shrubs and trees are always the best way, because in the wintertime they lose their leaves and let the sun come through, and in the summertime they foliage out and give us the shade we need. If you can't do that, then either a blind, an awning, or again the one of the window tints will do quite a bit in helping to reduce some of that solar gain and help prevent the sun from fading your carpets and things like that.
Yeah, it's too bad you can't really do a retrofit to get more overhang on your roof.
This is correct. Yeah, it's one of those things where hopefully the designs themselves are out there that are giving us the overhang that we need to. I'd really like to see them a little bit longer than what most of them are. Yeah. You know, usually about 30 inches is minimum.
And I suppose that also gives you a possible advantage, because it puts the drip line further away from the foundation.
Correct. And so that helps keep the water from wanting to soak in next to our foundation, reduce the amount of water coming through our small cracks in our concrete.
Yeah, okay. Let's see what we got next. Somebody in Sydney, they're line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, hi.
I was calling. I have an older house, and actually I have 2 questions, but first of all, I have an older house and like aluminum storm windows on the outside of it, and the gasket or whatever that keeps it from banging around has worn out. Is there somebody that replaces those?
Well, probably. However, new aluminum storm windows are about $90 a piece. To buy a whole new one, you can go and get them custom made to fit the windows. And if you figure what it costs to have somebody come out there per hour, by the time they drive their truck out to your house and then set up and then change the gaskets, you could probably almost buy new storm windows.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering if I could buy new windows, because obviously somebody did this as a cost-saving measure. So
aluminum self-storing windows are very good at helping reduce heat loss, particularly on the older houses that have single-pane glass. Matter of fact, a good storm window and a set of wood windows that have good putty and reasonable weather stripping can probably give you very close to the same performance as a new replacement window. So yes, I do like to see the storm windows when they do start rattling around and moving around. If the rubber seal that holds the glass in the frame itself, you're almost as well off just because of labor costs to get new storm windows for it.
Okay. Yeah. Because that's what I'm wondering about. I mean, new windows price, but then I don't know how I'm going to match. I mean, it's got a bunch of old woodwork trim in it. How am I going to be able to match up?
I am a big proponent of fixing up windows, because replacement windows, particularly ones that made of vinyl, definitely have a finite life. Vinyl does deteriorate with sunlight. The older they get, the more brittle they get, the more likely they are to crack. They are not going to last 100 years like a wood window. So I do like, if you want to replace them every once in a while, that's fine. But a good wood window, like say single glazed, as long as the glazing is in good condition and it's got a little bit of weather stripping around it, and you put a storm window on it to help reduce a lot of the air movement past the window, they will work quite well. A double pane window basically has a small air gap. The air gap is to prevent heat transfer from one pane of glass to the next. Air is our biggest insulator. When we talk, we need, like we were mentioning earlier, we need 15 or 16 inches of insulation up in the attic area. That insulation is merely to reduce airflow. It is an area where we trap air. We have dead space. If the air is not circulating or moving, it is not transferring heat. So if we have a good wood window that is sealed on the inside, we put a storm window on the outside to prevent air from moving past it, we reduce quite a bit of the heat loss through that window by having a good sealing storm. Now, I do not recommend sealing the storm windows at the bottom. You can caulk or seal the frames on 3 sides, but the bottom you need to leave open so that if you ever have the screen up, or storm window up, screen down, water can run out at the bottom.
Right. Okay.
there are glass companies here in town that you could take the storm window out, take the storm panes out, and take it to them, and they can either make you new panels for that, or they can reseat the glass and put in new rubber seals. If you're willing to take the panels out yourself and drive them to the glass company, that might be something that would be, save you a little bit of money over replacements. Sometimes parts are available, sometimes they aren't. Depends on the style you happen to have.
Right. Okay, well, good enough. Thank you.
All right, very good. And over to Belgium, another caller here, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to take serious exception with something you said about the trusses, sir.
Okay.
And you were talking about the lumber involved in the truss and the movement of the lumber in the trusses. You said it. The lumber that's the most dimensionally stable is the lumber that's from the edge of the outer side of the tree. That's not true, sir. The most stable lumber is the quarter sawn lumber that comes from the very center of the tree out to the outer edge, so that when you look at the 2x4 and the 2-inch thickness, you'll see the annual rings going straight up down vertically across those. It's like you're coming from the very center, the spoke of a wheel, from the center of the wheel out. The other types of lumber, which is plain cut, which is what you were describing, that has the most movement of it. The other, the one that's between the two, is what's called rift cut, which would have a 45 degree to that 2-inch thickness. And the unfortunate thing about the quarter sawn lumber, to get quarter sawn lumber, you waste the most lumber in the tree. You get the best yield from a log by cutting plain cut and just taking, as you saw, off the log, excluding the pith, which nobody ever keeps because that has much too much movement and causes lots of problems when you use the lumber.
Well, you use it for landscape timbers.
Yes, exactly. That's the only thing. But you don't really want to use the plain cut ones to make the most dimensionally stable lumber.
Well, the tree, of course, grows faster when it's younger, and so there is more meat between the rings, more wood between the rings on the tree. So when the tree gets older and the rings are closer together, the lumber is denser. You get one that has the tighter ring pattern. It's actually a heavier board than one of the inner boards.
I take an exception with you. That's not necessarily true. The width of the annual rings actually has as much to do with the density of the population in the forest. If you have a highly densely packed forest, you'll get much tighter rings because the trees tend to grow straight up higher, and they don't put on the width quite as well.
Correct, which is one of the reasons why we have problems with the lumber nowadays is we're doing farm-raised lumber where we're planting them so many feet apart and fertilizing them and growing them very rapidly.
And we're using types of trees that grow very rapidly. They've been bred to grow very. Today you can buy walnut trees as seedlings that will be big enough to harvest in 25 years. Your father, people who used lumber for a long time, they use trees that might have taken 150 years to get to the same size that a 25-year-old hybrid tree will get to. They're just ridiculously much faster growing. And they really don't have the strength that the slow-grown, very deep forest trees have. But like you say, those trees have disappeared rapidly because they are the most desirable trees. When you get the playing deck type card annual rings where you'll see 50, 60 annual rings per inch, that's very, very slowly grown timber that's been in the woods for a long, long time. And that also is a very stable lumber, just like you say.
Right.
But it really has to do with the more the tree, the actual way that a tree grows and the way that wood is interacted with the cellulose and the lignin. It really is best to buy the pieces of wood that go from the center out, because like I said, quarter sawn, I'm sure you've heard of quarter sawn oak that a lot of people like in the arts and crafts. That was really the very slowest grown, very, very dimensionally stable. When you make tables and chairs and stuff like that, you want that wood to have a table because it won't expand and contract across the length of the table near as much as a plain sawn board would.
Well, unfortunately, our truss companies are not using oak. They're using a southern pine. They're using something that's grown quickly.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't really matter what type of tree it is. Always the quarter sawn is the most dimensionally stable in all the trees, whether it's oak or walnut or if it's teak, any lumber you want.
Well, okay, I'm going to stand by mine just a little bit in saying that the truss companies are not using quarter sawn lumber. They're going to use pretty much a standard cut lumber. And so there again, the more rings we can get into it, of course, the denser it's going to be. But that being said, there's not a lot of difference between inside and outside as far as the truss is concerned. The truss is an engineered piece, so it's actually designed to be stable. Unfortunately, not dimensionally stable, but to at least be able to support the weight load of the roof. And it does move with temperature and humidity changes, and the bottom of it does not move as much because it stays one temperature, one humidity level. So there is a movement and a truss rise.
Yeah. I'm going to jump in here. We only have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. You guys can settle us over a beer sometime and give you guys can trade phone numbers. Questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. I got a question, and give us a call. Scott Spies is our guest from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is our monthly show on home maintenance. Well, given what you say, I think is true, because of the demand for lumber for construction is so high, and you can't wait for a tree to grow to be 100 years old before you get the tree. So now what we have here, as you say, is we've moved to things that grow really fast, and mm-hmm. the quality, you just don't get the quality of materials that you did 100 years ago.
This is why our building industry has modified their use of the lumber. Instead of dimensional lumber, we're using a lot of laminate lumber, OSB board, oriented strand board. This is where we take and put the lumber through a flake or a chipper, and we then take all the chips and glue them back together. And we end up with a board that instead, or a sheet of plywood or something, that instead of having the grain all running in one direction for each ply, it runs in multiple directions. So it doesn't have the expansion and traction. Our glue lam beams are I-joist, structurally engineered beams that don't have the expansion and traction of dimensional lumber, because our dimensional lumber quality has gone down. What I like to refer to as second and third growth lumber. They cut down the forest, so they want more trees. Let's plant them back in the same spot, but this time we're going to move them a little farther apart and get them in 20 or 30 years, what used to take 150 years to grow. So, yeah, we do have lumber that isn't quite as strong, isn't quite as stable, so we end up with all the new style. And the key is, of course, keeping the construction industry abreast with how to install this, because if I have an engineered beam, I can't put it together like I had a 2x10. You have to make sure that it is the joints, the connections have proper hangers. We have to make sure they don't modify the top and bottom cords of joists, things like that. So yeah, the industry is evolving around the fact that we can't get the high quality lumber that we had, and now most of the good lumber does go to like furniture and more decorative uses.
Yeah, and so you can actually, if you have something that you make out of wood that essentially looks like a metal I-beam, like you would use in a skyscraper, is that as structurally as strong as a solid beam of wood that you at one point you might have actually been able to get a solid piece that would do that?
So, yeah, if you were to take a 2x10 and then you take a 2x10, say, I-joist, the 2x10 I-joist is stronger. It's actually more dimensionally stable and can span a longer distance than a dimensional 2x10.
Yeah, right. I've got a couple callers here. Well, I'm sure we should be able to get them in. Aurora, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Yeah.
You're talking about storm windows, and I had a question to ask in regards to, I have aluminum storm windows on my home. And they're old. I mean, they're not some new and improved. But I have a problem with where I live, a lot of road noise. And is there a type of storm window that is better at, noise levels or anything like that?
No, glass generally is not known for having a good sound control. It's solid enough, the sound waves tend to go right through it. So at that particular point, I would say no, there's not one that is a whole lot quieter. You can do some weather stripping around the wood window, your prime window, and see if that doesn't reduce some of the noise. But the storm window is not going to help much. And if you try and seal the storm window too tightly, you actually end up with condensation issues between the two panes of glass, between the prime window and the storm window. So a storm window should always have a little bit of a gap at the bottom, or at least have some drain holes. And your weather stripping your ceiling on your prime window is one that's going to do most of your energy conservation as well as your sound control.
Okay. And there are windows that are made for keeping out sound, or are they not? Or?
They spend more time working on the energy portion of it, since that seems to be the flow of construction technology right now. But as you make them better insulating, yes, they do tend to absorb a little bit more sound. Wood, of course, transmits wood sound fairly well, where vinyl tends to absorb a little bit more. So a vinyl window can be a little quieter than a wood window.
Really?
The vinyl is softer, so it won't transfer the noise through it quite as much, particularly an old wood window where the wood has gotten very hard, very dense.
Yeah, right, because these windows are from the 50s.
Yeah. My guess is if you're worried about sound, yes, I think if you were to put in a replacement window, you would notice a reduction in the noise in the house.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. Very good. Thank you. Over to Champagne, line one. Hello.
Yes. Good afternoon. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Totally off other subjects. Are there things that are safe to put in toilet tanks that keep the bowls more clean? I've seen lots of advertisements in magazines and in catalogs that say, oh, keep it clean for 6 months or whatever. Are these enzymes? Are they chlorine? And A, are they useful? And B, do they harm the inside of the tank, especially the sealants?
Okay, well, that is a little out of my area of expertise.
Okay.
Most of them do have some type of chlorine or some type of germ killer with them. And, of course, the more chlorine we put in it, the harder it is on the rubber seal on the flapper.
Right.
Which, of course, are relatively inexpensive. I think you can buy all the parts to replace the inside of a toilet for under $25.
Huh.
The flapper and the valve and the washers that hold the tank on and everything. You're not going to hurt the toilet itself. It's a ceramic, so it's pretty much impervious to about anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I'm going to have to say that I don't have any experience with which ones will work better on that.
Okay. Do these enzymes ones work?
Everybody's got the newer, better deal, and everybody thinks that they want to have the thing that says it works the best. And basically, if it's killing off the germs, like, say, basically chlorine, it's going to work. As far as the enzymes, I would not have the information on that.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, thank you. We have somebody here who has an email question for you. He says, I have a cinder block basement wall that is bellied out maybe 1 to 2 inches off plumb at and around the ground level on one wall. And looks like it was that way when they bought the house. This hasn't changed since he bought the home 3 years ago. How serious do you think this might be? Person here says he tends to think it's not a big deal, but what do you think?
Well, I know here in Champaign County we have some type of movement in just about every hollow masonry wall, masonry block, clay tile, etc. It's from the expansion contraction of the soil outside the house, keeping your downspouts extended away, keeping your grading such that we're not saturating the soil next to the foundation will reduce some of that movement. If we get a big drought, you might even want to water the soil right next to the foundation so it doesn't shrink away and allow more soil in there that would then, when the moisture level comes back out, have an inward force. I will agree that most of the time the inward bowing of your concrete walls, your block walls, is not significant enough to wave a red flag and panic about. My rule of thumb is to hang a plumb bob off the wood framing down over the wall, and if it is more than about an inch or inch and a half from the wall at the floor, then it's probably time to start putting in some type of reinforcement, a wood fin wall, a steel C-channel. I've seen them drill it into the cores and fill it with concrete, something like that. So it is something to be looked at, and if it does move in too far, it can be a definite structural issue, but most of the time, it's not a big deal.
Okay. And just to come back to something, and we've talked about this before, and the fact that if, say, we have a really prolonged dry period, you know, say over the summertime, that the dirt that's up against the foundation can indeed shrink and pull away so that then you'll get a little gap there, which tends to fill itself in, little stones, some more dirt, stuff is going to fall down in there.
Mm-hmm.
So that then once we get moisture again and the soil swells up again, that actually can push. It's enough to actually push a wall.
We actually get a little bit of lateral pressure in there, and it will start working the wall. Yeah, I'm sure that his movement is actually in an end wall, which is going parallel with his wood framing, so it's really not holding up a large weight load of the house. It's holding up an end wall someplace, but it doesn't have a lot of weight down on it. A concrete block wall, the more weight you put on it, the stronger it is resisting that lateral movement. The block doesn't like to open up if there's a big weight sitting on top of it. So, yeah, usually the end walls are the first ones to start cracking, and it's almost always from moisture on the outside of the house, expanding and contracting the soil, getting some movement, getting some settlement. So keeping the drainage out in a way. I mean, gutters, it's amazing. Gutters, folks, keep them clean. Keep them on the house. I know. My home inspections, everybody's like, well, you always tell me to put gutter extensions on it. Well, almost every house I come across needs gutter extensions. Get that water 5 feet away from the house. It'll really help out.
Okay. And does it make, if you get it even more, if you get it 10 feet, 12 feet, is it even better? Or is it when you get to 5 feet, you would just say that's probably.
Depends on the situation. If we've got a very flat grade or a negative grade, then yes, farther is better.
All right. Any last thoughts you'd like to leave with folks this time around?
Well, it's, as you started out our show, air conditioning season is around the corner, so check those air filters, get them changed, and while you're at it, might as well change the batteries and the smoke alarms and CO detectors. And right now, I want to remind people, CO detectors are required in all homes, whether new, used, whatever. If you've got a house, it's supposed to have carbon monoxide detectors,
okay.
So get them put in.
All right. Well, that's what we leave for this time around. Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He is on the program every month. It is always on a Monday to take questions on home maintenance, and we'll see you again next month. Thank you.
All right. Thank you a lot, David.